Been listening to Labrish. My name is Haptah Selassie, and the program will be back next week at 2 following the work of the Midnight Ravers. Stay tuned for Back of the Book, 99.5 FM WBAI, 99.5 FM New York, and WBAI.org by way of the internet. And it's time for Back of the Book.
Hello, this is Radio's Uncle Sidney. When I'm out and about, folks comes up to me and says, "You should be ashamed." But when they calms down, they says how much they loves WBAI. That's WBAI New York and WBAI.org. Back in the day, we had commentaries by Malcolm X, Ayn Rand, Abby Hoffman, and William F. Buckley Jr. Imagine them folks in the same room at the same time. Nowadays, we've got Bob Fass, the founder of the Feast. Amy Goodman, you know her, we got her. Michio Kaku, the smartest guy in the world. Shows that helps you not to get evicted. Top-of-the-line news and interviews. Insane artists and musicians. All okay, okay. We went nuts for a while back there. But now we're okay. We're like your crackhead cousin that's making good. So we know you're pulling for us. Go, go, run right now to WBAI.org and look around. See where we've gone. You can even subscribe online. Believe me, you'll be glad you did. Stay tuned.
It should be about 5 a.m., and you're listening to All Life Day Plus 54 Years Radio WBAI New York.
No, I know we're not in Kansas.
Good goddamn morning. How the hell are you? This is WBAI New York. The program is Back of the Book. My name is R. Paul Martin. She is Radio's Pickles of the North. Good morning, my dear.
Good morning to you, my dear, and a hearty hello to our dear 19 listeners, wherever they may be.
And you can find a little bit more out about what we're going to talk about here by going up to my website at glib.com, glib.com. You can go there, look around at things. When you get there, you'll see a blue navigation frame in the left-hand side of your screen. At the top, it will say Latest Back of the Book Program Links. Click on that link, and you'll go to the webpage for tonight's program. The WBAI website and the archives seem to be functioning. This is our 78th pandemic episode of Back of the Book. It's pre-recorded. This program was recorded on Friday for airing on Saturday morning. If things have happened between then and when you're hearing this program, we won't be referencing them on this program. A recorded program cannot be as up-to-date as a live program, but this is what we have to do in these dangerous times. Of course, the top story in the worldwide news of the week is we have bounced back up to 118 followers on Twitter. Oh, we're coming back. It's a resurgence. We lost a couple. Now we got one back. Woohoo! The next WBAI local station board meeting will be held on Wednesday, March 9th, 2022 at 7 p.m. on Zoom, even though Zoom compromises privacy and security. We had an LSB meeting this past Tuesday, February 9th. We elected some LSB members to some Pacifica National Board committees, and we populated some mandated local WBAI committees. We also had a very long presentation by the WBAI general manager. According to the Johns Hopkins website, COVID-19 cases in the whole world reached 407,714,754 on Friday, and global deaths reached 5,797,777. In America, the number of cases as of Friday was 77,535,578, and the death toll in America had reached 917,443. So 17,548 people have died of COVID-19 in America since our last program 1 week ago. This week's death rate is slightly lower than it was last week. It's still a huge number of deaths every week, however. The pandemic is not over, even though a lot of people seem to think it is. By the time this program airs on Saturday morning, all of those figures we quoted will be higher, of course. This was all mostly preventable. So today, as we record this, but yesterday, as you hear this being broadcast over the air, about 4,000 city workers are facing termination of their jobs over their refusal to get vaccinated against COVID-19. Mayor de Blasio initiated this initiative, which took effect on November 1st, and he said that if they didn't get vaccinated, they lose their jobs. And then when Mayor Adams took office, he said he'd enforce that mandate. As far as we know, that mass termination of anti-vaxxers is in the process of being carried out by the city. We've heard that a whole bunch of the city workers who were staring at the imminent prospect of losing their jobs have gone and gotten vaccinated. The New York City municipal workforce is about 375,000 workers strong, so the 4,000 who refused to get vaccinated are not a large percentage. Still, they had a march over the Brooklyn Bridge the other day to protest the mandate, and some firefighters have formed a group they call Bravest for Choice. Some of them are saying that getting vaccinated or not should be their choice, and it is. They can get vaccinated or not. The city has a choice of mandating certain health requirements for its jobs. It makes sense to keep your workforce as healthy as possible and lower the odds of their infecting others with the virus. It's also uniformed workers' choice to wear a uniform or not. But if they refuse to wear their uniform, they can be fired. There are a lot of things that are required for certain jobs. And unvaccinated people are 97 times more likely to die from COVID-19 than vaccinated people are. More than 540 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines have been administered in the United States, and serious side effects are very rare.
Yes, it feels like, this is Pickles, by the way, it feels like people are just going insane. Perhaps they've been driven insane by the pandemic, because I can't come up with any other explanation as to why people are working to hurt themselves and to hurt other people. And another case in point of that is what's going on in Canada right now and apparently spreading around the world. Again, a minority of people who don't want to be vaccinated, who feel that, you know, they have a right to trample on everybody else's rights. And so they've been blocking border crossings, I think at least three of them in Canada. They've been holding Ottawa, the capital city of Canada, hostage at this point. Since you're listening to this on Saturday morning, many things may have happened between Friday and Saturday because the federal government has finally decided they're going to act. And the big thing that they were going to do is make people lose their licenses, their commercial license to drive a truck, people that are blocking all those border crossings and blocking the city streets, or trying to all across Canada, and perhaps bring criminal charges against them. And you know what happens when you get a criminal charge against you and you have a criminal record in Canada? You have a big hard time traveling internationally. This has been since 9/11. So if you're an actual trucker and you want to do cross-border trade, you're not going to be able to do that. So perhaps they should have thought about that. I think they feel they can act with impunity the way the protesters No, the insurrectionists did on January 6th. They can do whatever they want. They think they're right. Every crazy crackpot idea under the sun that's been spewed forth by conspiracy theorists and anti-vaccination people are their defense. So, you know, the cops, they're trying to avoid having violent confrontation. But I think a lot of these people want a violent confrontation. And that's why they've been doing this for days and days and days. And you know what? I originally had wanted to talk about St. Valentine. But this is where we are in the pandemic. All I say to you is, those of you who are vaccinated, great. Those of you who aren't, good luck. And I don't know, eat chocolate.
Well, thank you, Pickles of the North. And also, maybe we'll find out how many of them are actually truckers.
How many? Because it's, you know, the majority of the people in the trucking industry who drive those trucks back and forth across Canada from both sides of the border, you know, to the United States, Americans and Canadians, they are vaccinated and they are trying to do their jobs. And this blocking of the border now is keeping them from doing their job. It's shutting down manufacturing in both countries. It's really amazing to me that it's reached this point. And I hope it stops soon.
People of Earth, attention. People of Earth, attention. This is a voice speaking to you from thousands of miles beyond your planet.
A magnetic storm caused by a solar flare has knocked out about 49 of Elon Musk's SpaceX satellites. The Starlink satellites were launched on February 3rd, and they were orbiting about 210 miles above the Earth's surface. The magnetic storm ruffled the Earth's atmosphere and made it expand a little bit. That little bit was enough to start increasing the drag on the Starlink satellites, and they started to lose orbital energy and come lower into the atmosphere, where they lost even more orbital energy. As a result, 49 of them have burned up in the atmosphere. The SpaceX people say that the Starlink satellites are made to completely disintegrate upon reentry in the atmosphere, so at least no one's going to get hit on the head with one of them. Well, the sun certainly has something to say about what we can do in space.
Hey, I thought we wouldn't have time for this, but we're going to make a little time for it. St. Valentine's Day, 5th century Rome. And this is a little excerpt from Charles Penati's Extraordinary Origins of Everyday Things, which is a book from 1987, I think. St. Valentine's Day, 5th century Rome. The Catholic Church's attempt to paper over a popular pagan fertility rite with the clubbing, death, and decapitation of one of its own martyrs is the origin of this lover's holiday. As early as the 4th century BC, the Romans engaged in an annual young man's rite of passage to the god Lupercus. The names of teenage women were placed in a box and drawn at random by adolescent men. Thus, a man was assigned a woman companion for their mutual entertainment and pleasure, often sexual, for the duration of a year, after which another lottery was staged. Determined to put an end to this 800-year-old practice, the early church fathers sought a lover's saint to replace the deity Lupercus. They found a likely candidate in Valentine, a bishop who had been martyred some 200 years earlier. In Rome in AD 270, Valentine had enraged the mad emperor Claudius II, who had issued an edict forbidding marriage. Claudius felt that married men made poor soldiers because they were loath to leave their families for battle. The empire needed soldiers, so Claudius, never one to fear unpopularity, abolished marriage. Valentine, bishop of Interama, invited young lovers to come to him in secret, where he joined them in the sacrament of matrimony, Claudius learned of this friend of lovers and had the bishop brought to the palace. The emperor, impressed with the young priest's dignity and conviction, attempted to convert him to the Roman gods to save him from otherwise certain execution. Valentine refused to renounce Christianity and imprudently attempted to convert the emperor. On February 24th, 270, Valentine was clubbed, stoned, then beheaded. History also claims that while Valentine was in prison awaiting execution, he fell in love with the blind daughter of the jailer, Asterius. Through his unswerving faith, he miraculously restored her sight. He signed a farewell message to her, "From your Valentine," a phrase that would live long after its author died. So they went from, the church basically said, we don't like this celebration. So what they decided to do was, instead of having a lottery where you put your number in the hat, and when they said, we can still have the lottery, but they changed it to, and you're going to pick a saint out of there and emulate their saintly ways.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that was a real substitute.
I mean, really. Can you imagine when they first decided to do this and everybody's like lining up to see who gets who in the lottery? Oh,
man.
I know. So disappointing.
That's certainly an interesting way to pair people off that they had in the Roman Empire. Thank you, Pickles of the North. Revelations continue to come in from Congress's January 6th committee. We now hear that former New York City mayor and Donald Trump's lawyer, and later public clown, Rudy Giuliani, called Antrim, Michigan County prosecuting attorney James Rossiter in the weeks after the 2020 presidential election to demand that he hand over the voting machines used in the election to Trump's team so they could search for supposed signs of fraud. Rossiter told the Washington Post all of this. And, you know, in reality, Biden won Michigan by 150,000 votes. And given the number of votes in Antrim County, they wouldn't have made any difference anyway. But, you know, the thin end of the wedge, I think, if they could have gotten this guy to give them the voting machines. Yeah, give partisan people the voting machines. That's a good thing. If they had been able to get him to give up the voting machines, they might have been able to get others to do it. Anyway, this was around the same time that Trump was caught on tape asking a Georgia elections official to, quote, find, unquote, enough votes to overturn his narrow loss in Georgia. And they're looking into basically seeing about putting him in jail over that. I hope they do. Trump has since said at one of his Bund rallies that he wanted Pence to actually overturn the 2020 election. He hadn't used those words before, but now he's coming out with it. Maybe it was a slip. He knew it all along. He was trying to overturn an election, but there he is saying overturn the 2020 election. Pence took a year to say anything real about this, but he has now said that no one person should be able to do that. I guess some civics lesson finally sank into him. The congressional committee investigating the attack on the Capitol has also uncovered unexplained gaps in former President Trump's official White House phone logs from January 6th. Official records that were turned over to the panel only reveal a few calls that Trump made and received on the day of the insurrection, even though witnesses say the then president made many calls as the violence he'd instigated was going on. Some of Trump's calls have already been reported or discussed by recipients, like a phone call with Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican of Alabama, and fellow far right-wing bad guy, Senator Mike Lee, Republican of Utah. These calls do not appear on the official log. And because it lacks a complete official record of Trump's calls for that day, the committee has subpoenaed phone records of Trump allies aides, and family members to map his contacts on January 6th. Trump's actions certainly appear to violate the Presidential Records Act, and that act orders that these records be preserved. Representative Carolyn Maloney, Democrat of New York, said that Trump, quote, potentially violated a criminal law by intentionally removing records, including communications with a foreign leader, from the White House, and reportedly attempting to destroy records by tearing them up, unquote. Trump is denying reports that he clogged the White House toilets by flushing wads of paper that could have included potentially damaging documents. So he was working on it. We know that Trump destroyed official presidential documents because some of them were retrieved by the National Archives workers, and they had to tape them back together in order to send them to the congressional committee. And, of course, they've gotten 15 boxes of records from Mar-a-Lago in the past little while here, but he's had those things for a year. So does anybody think that he didn't have people going through those 15 boxes, getting rid of anything that might not be flattering to him? Oh, boy, oh, boy. I hope he doesn't succeed in blanking out everything that he did that was wrong. I want this guy to go to prison for a long time.
At this point, I should say that this is WBAI New York. The program is Back of the Book. He is R. Paul Martin, and I am Radio's Pickles of the North.
Life Day. It was on February 12th, 1968. So since you're listening to this program being broadcast on February 12th, 2022, the event I'm talking about happened exactly 54 years ago. We're doing something quite unusual for us here. We're going to play the Talk About Life Day that I did 4 years ago. I think it mostly hits the points I wanted to make, and it will fit into this radio program. We did a longer piece about Life Day in 2007, but that was when we had a two-hour program, and that segment just won't fit into this program's one-hour format. So you'll hear me at the start talking about the 50th anniversary of the event, but this is the 54th anniversary of it. The segment starts out talking about my unathletic early youth and goes on to talk about when I was on track teams in school. It goes on from there. Pickles and I think that this story says a thing or two, and that's why we're presenting it again. This segment has been edited from its original form. It was done live, and while I was getting to a part of the story that I found it particularly difficult to talk about, one of the privileged people at BAI walked in to master control while we were live on the air and started rooting about looking for some device he had left behind. I had to stop doing the segment and tell him that it had been put away safely by an ops person. That part has been removed from the segment. I also took the opportunity to remove some of the pauses and ums that were in the live recording. That recording is ripped from a CDR console check we did at the station for that program, so the audio quality is quite good. We're going to talk about Life Day. We've done it before, but this is a special one because it's a 50th anniversary one. You remember a couple of weeks ago, we went on and I talked about being drafted on that very day, January 16th. So I was drafted on January 16th, 1968. So around now, I would have been in the Army for about 3 weeks. 3 entire weeks in the Army, and I'd be in basic training, and all that crap that happens would be happening. And, now we come to this other story, and some of you have heard this. This, of course, since we only have a 55-minute radio program these days, this won't be quite as elaborate as some of the previous year's renditions of talking about this. So this will not be as long as it has been. So those of you suffering through it, again, having suffered through it before, you will not have to suffer through too much of it. Also, I've got some new stuff here to talk about regarding it, because how can you ever do stuff about this, Arpal? Well, it's called digging through things and finally finding some old stuff and putting it together for the program. Monday is the 12th of February, and that is the 50th anniversary of what I call Life Day. The groundwork for Life Day started getting laid down in 1961. Oh, boy, he's telling some really old stories now. 1969, I was new to high school. I was a freshman. I was 14 years old. And I was going into high school. It was a new thing. And track, running track, was a big deal thing in grammar school. There was a track team. And, oh, boy, you know, the track team, it was a kind of high status thing. And kids could be in it. I could hardly run. I had what was called a chicken breast. You know what your sternum bone is? The sternum bone is that bone, the solid bone in the center of your chest, the front of your chest, front and center, that all of the ribs connect to in the front. It has a certain width to it. Mine did not. My condition was called chicken breast because it came to almost a point. It was like my entire sternum was, you know, maybe half an inch wide and maybe less. And it just came to a point. You know, I could be an icebreaker with that chest. And so I could not run. I would try to run and I would run like less than a half a block. Way less than half a block. And I would be winded and I'd be, I could not run. But track was a big thing in grammar school. And it was, oh, you know, all this stuff. Because people knew I was, you know, unable to move around well, they never really invited me on, except for one brother. I went to a Catholic school, and one brother, I can't remember his name, did suggest, you know, you would be good for the track team. You should come out for the track team. And I was, oh, well, I was kind of flattering, you know, and because I was this complete non-athletic kid who was sickly mostly. And he said, oh, yes, come on. He was talking me up to it. And I said, oh, I don't know, you know, because I knew that I, you know, the second I go out there and I try to run, I'm going to get about at most 20 yards. And then I'm going to either have to stop entirely or just start walking and walking slowly and looking like I'm wrecked. And so I said, oh, I don't know about that. And it wasn't for athleticism, because a couple of months later, there was an outing, and that brother was caught with some boy from another school doing things in the bushes with people's pants down, okay? So I said, oh, that's what he was talking me up about. When I was 14, I had a very miserable, tiny chest, inadequate. However, I had a really nice ass. And anyway, I had some attributes, and anyway, so track was a big thing in school. I couldn't do it. I tried soccer for a couple of months because I wanted to do something. I tried soccer because nobody else would do it. We couldn't field a team. The track team kids had track to do, and nobody else wanted to do this, and so I tried out for it, and it was a thing of if you show up, you're on the team, and, you know, it was a thing of if you show up, try to grab somebody else because we don't have enough people for a real team, and we really didn't. So, you know, you would go out there, you would try it. It only lasted a couple of months. I think we played two or three games or something. I think we practiced twice, and it was pretty much nothing. So there was that. So then high school happens. It's September 1961. And so in high school, I was determined to start my life over. Yes, I knew when I was 13 going on to 14, my life was a miserable failure. After all, the church kept telling me this, yeah, telling me how awful it was because I was, let's say I was, as the song puts it, making love while I was all alone an awful lot, and the church frowned on this. I also had lots of impure thoughts about the other boys. Church frowned on that too. So I was, you know, not getting a lot of positive vibes out of the church. Anyway, I was going to start my life over. And I said, I'm going to join the track team if they'll let me. And so for the track team, they didn't have tryouts. It was just like the soccer team in grammar school. Show up. Say you want to do it. Now, in high school, we got phys ed because that's required. At least it was required in those days for all high schools to have phys ed. And so I went in there, and you were issued a gym suit, which was a T-shirt with your school name on it, St. Francis Prep, and a pair of gym shorts. The sneakers were your problem, and that's what we would go in with. So we start out, and they say, take your gym suit and come on out, and you'll go to the track team. And so you got these kids who are there who have uniforms. Then you've got those of us who are showing up for the first time, and we're in just our gym suits, and we stand out. And they walk us over to McCarran Park because it was up in Greenpoint. St. Francis Prep was in Greenpoint at the time. They took us to McCarran Park, and they said they introduced us to something new called jogging. I'd never heard of it before. People just generally didn't do it then. And so they would have us jog and then walk. It was a quarter-mile track, and in the course of the day, they had us jog part of the way and walk. And that's what they did. And that's all we did the first day. And we went around the track a total of 8 times, and we were done. I said, we did 2 miles! We did 2 miles! That's amazing! Oh! I was just flabbergasted. Now, you know, walking I could do enough. The jogging, you know, I mean, it wasn't competitive. Everybody stayed together. So everybody's going as slow as the slowest person, which was generally me. And, you know, we just go through it. Over time, I was, you know, after a while, I got a uniform and I was a member of the track team. Again, it was a thing of if you keep showing up, we'll give you a uniform. And that means you're really on the track team. And they did that. And it started out with cross-country track. And that was a long run. That was a, what was that? It was a mile and a quarter. It was a mile and a quarter. And you went up there and it was at Van Cortlandt Park. And it was basically you start out on this flat field and you run and there's a little hill. And you run up the side of the hill and you run down the side of the hill. And you go around the base of the hill and there's the finish line. It's a mile and a quarter. And, you know, to me, this is a gigantic thing. I'm going to run a mile and a quarter. And so we did it. I was terrible. I was really, really terrible. I could not run. I could hardly breathe. I kept at it. And I was lucky that they didn't cut you from the team because you were a lousy runner. But I kept at it, and I kept at it, and went through being a freshman. I was a freshman. And we ran through these things. There were various things because I was a short kid and hardly weighed anything. I was in the what they call midget class. And if Max is out there, I don't want to hear anything about this, Maxwell. And so I was in the midget class. There were some kids that were sub-midgets. And they would have classes because the big kids could run fast and they had these gigantic long legs. The little kids had little legs. So you had the sub-midget 110-yard dash or something. We recently found some of my old track placards, whatever they're called. I don't even know what they're called anymore. Numbers. It was a number that they would pin to your track suit, your uniform. And that was so that you could be identified during the track meet. And we found some of these. And I found that on May 4th, 1962, at the Catholic High School Athletic Association track meet, I ran a quarter of a mile in 64.5 seconds, which for the average person would be okay. For some kid who has been studiously attending track practice every day since September, that's rather poor. But I kept at it, 64.2 for a quarter of a mile. So I kept at it. I was really awful. They didn't cut me. They just said, all right, you're in it. And I kept going. January 1963, I ran the half mile in 2 minutes, 36.4 seconds. That's slow, folks. And in December of 1963, I ran a half mile in 2 minutes and 26 seconds. A little bit better, but, you know, not that great. And then a month later, I made it in 2:23.7. was my stuff. Then I was running a mile. I ran a mile in April of 64. I ran a mile in 5 minutes, 21.1 seconds. My fastest half mile was 2 minutes and 6 seconds. My fastest mile was 5 minutes and 2 seconds. And even a track coach in high school said, you know, see these other guys here, you see their times. We could maybe do something with that. I don't know what we can do with you. It was sort of, why don't you just go away? You know, they weren't cutting you, but why don't you just go away? You really stink. I'll tell you this, spoiler, there's a thing called a novice. Mostly as a freshman, you're expected to just, you know, do freshman events and all of that because you're 14. And you do this stuff. Some of the kids are 13. And you do this stuff. During that and after that, there is a thing called a novice. And a lot of the events are set up for kids who have a certain amount of experience and ability. The highest you get is varsity. They'll have like the varsity 100-yard dash, the varsity quarter mile, half mile, mile, whatever. Those are the varsity events. Under that, you have the JV, junior varsity, which sometimes they'd have it, sometimes they wouldn't. If you weren't in the varsity, you could be junior varsity. Anybody could be junior varsity. They'd throw freshmen into the junior varsity. And what you had also was your novice. If you started out, you were a novice. And in order to become somebody in varsity, you had to do something called breaking your novice, which means you had to win or come in at a certain point in a novice event. You had to score well at a novice event. Most of the time, this meant coming in first. Sometimes it meant coming in first, second, or third. Spoiler, I never lost my novice in high school. I was a 17-year-old. I was the oldest novice in any high school in Brooklyn. Possibly any high school in the Catholic High School Athletic Association in all of Greater New York. As I said, I was a terrible runner. And right about now, I think it's time for us to do a station break. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, broadcasting from a transmitter and antenna atop 4 Times Square, going through a new studio somewhere in downtown Brooklyn and originating in our living room somewhere else in Brooklyn. The program is back of the book. My name is R. Paul Martin. She is Radio's Pickles of the North. And you can find out more by going up to my website at glib.com, glib.com. You can also go to the official website of this radio station at wbai.org. So after a while, you know, sophomore year, a trend showed up and it stayed up through the next couple of years. I was all alone in the standings for most races. What happened was I was running the short races early on, and then I had a friend who was running long races, and he had talent. And I said, well, I want to hang around with him, so I'll run the long races too. So I started running the long races. They said, okay. You know, nobody cared what I wanted to do. They'd put me in. They just didn't have enough kids, so it wasn't competitive. So I was allowed to do this. And I stank at long distance as well as short distance. So what happened was, with a short race, there's sort of a big bunch and it spreads out. In a long race, it spreads out more. And what you have is you have the kids who are decent runners. They're up at the front. And then you have a space. And then you have a bunch of kids in the back who form a group because they've just started this. This is usually kids who are freshmen, kids who have just said, I'm going to try out for track. And they try it for a little bit, and they've only been doing it for like a month. And so after a couple of years, there was the group in front, the group in back, in the space in the middle. That's where I was. Now, I had done well enough so that a kid who's on his very first track meet and has no talent, he's in back of me. But the kids who have been there as long as I have, they're not even in the race. They're in the varsity. Everybody else is in the varsity. I'm there. I'm like a sophomore, then a junior, then a senior. And I've got these kids who are freshmen and sophomores mostly in front of me. And that's about it. And that's how it went for all of high school. I was in this own little group. Also, what happened, the kids in front of me, they would break their novice and all of that. Some of them would and they would not be in there. And new kids would come up. And so I'd be there. I'm 16, and 14-year-olds are whizzing past me. Kids who have been running track for 2 months are running past me. Because not everybody who starts with only 2 months of practice stinks. Some people are good at it. And so I'm there, and these other much younger kids are way ahead of me. Other younger kids that were in back of me, so there's that. And the reason why there was always a pack in back of me was that some kids gave up. That's what mostly happened. The kids in back of me gave up. They would try it once and leave, once or twice and leave, because finishing so far back was embarrassing, and they didn't want to be embarrassed. I apparently knew no embarrassment and kept going. But they would be replaced. For a good part of the year, they would be replaced. Then around May and June, there weren't any of those kids anymore. So in May and June, I would be dead last. Anyway, yes, the May and June ho-hums. But I plugged on. I kept running. I ran all 4 years. I got into college. And I said, yeah, I was in the track team. And they said, okay. And they didn't give you a tryout. They said, come on in. And I ran with them. And I stank. And eventually what happened was I was running, and then I got appendicitis, and that took me out. And then I came back and said, well, I had appendicitis. Okay, you can go. And so I ran for a bit for another semester, and they said, ugh. And then I came back for another semester, and I'm running, and I'm not doing well at all. And, you know, the track coach figures he doesn't want to waste his time even having me around. So basically I got told, turn in your track uniform, you're off the team, you can't do this. So that was it. So there I was, having done all of this track running and not doing well at all. Fast forward, as we said, January 16th, 1968, R. Paul gets drafted. So I'm in the Army. Mistreatment is the norm in the Army. You know, it's, we're going to make men out of yous. Ugh. People. And so mistreatment, they think, oh yeah, a lot of it is sadistic. Some of it is, some of these idiots really think, oh yeah, I'm gonna make a man out of this boy here, and I'm gonna, they, some of them really think that. It was stupid stuff. So we're 3 weeks into the Army. It's dumb. It's basic training. And we're in these barracks. We're in these 1942 barracks, World War II barracks. They have a thing. There is a meningitis epidemic sweeping through the Army barracks in Fort Jackson and Fort Gordon, Georgia. I'm in Fort Gordon, Georgia. And spinal meningitis is sweeping through the whole place. So they say fresh air is the cure-all for it. So they make sure all the bedding is aired out every day. And then at night, they have the windows open. And they put in what are called duck boards, which I think were called duct boards, but the lifers couldn't pronounce the T, so they became duck boards. Anyway, it's a little wooden arrangement that you put in the window so that the wind does not come straight through the window and freeze you. It basically angles the air up. So there I was in the upper bunk. Yes, if you're in the upper bunk and you're by a window, the duct board aims all the wind, all that cold wind, up at you. Ah, very nice. And then the furnace broke. It was 3 degrees Fahrenheit that night. I got sick. I was sick that night. I threw up, and I didn't do well. They get us up. You know, in the Army, they get you up early in the morning. Yeah, you got to get up early in the morning. And everybody was cold. I was all right. I didn't feel that bad. I felt kind of crummy, but I wasn't that cold. Okay, so I took a shower. A lot of people skipped a shower, which is a big deal in the Army. People are getting up, and they're getting up, and they're staying wrapped in blankets because it's 3 degrees. And, you know, I didn't feel so good. So I'm taking a shower. Everybody's shivering, and I am so hot, I am not shivering. So, all right. I'm feeling funny, and I didn't feel great that day. Now you get lectures in the Army. So we had an outdoor lecture. They sit you in these bleacher stands, and there's a ROTC lieutenant who's there giving us a lecture. Reserve Officer Training Corps is ROTC. It means when he was in college, that was one of the things he took up. And then when he got out of college, they made him a second lieutenant in the Army. And so he's giving us a lecture. It was boring and stupid. People are starting to fall asleep because he's boring. So he yells at people, makes them stand up. If you start nodding off, he stands up. Well, I was doing that too. I was nodding. I was starting to pass out. Makes me stand up. So I'm standing up and I'm saying, whoa, this isn't so good because I'm not standing. I'm wobbling back and forth. And so when he gets done, he says, all right, everybody over there. Well, we'd been there a long while. It was cold out, and bladders demand things. And so there was a lot of high grass, and a lot of us went in there, and we went into the tall grass and contributed some fixed nitrogen to the grass. It was February, but hey, the grass still might appreciate fixed nitrogen. Well, the ROTC lieutenant showed us he was ROTC by coming out yelling at people and calling us snacks. This is a dead giveaway because I knew somebody who was in ROTC, and it's college. It's stupid. It's like a frat, and it's a lot of stupid, childish stuff. And so, well, you know, when somebody does something that, isn't up to par, they go, oh, you're a snack. Yeah, this is a college kind of thing. By the way, in Vietnam, wow, that was a good way to get killed. Oh, hey, you snack. Oh, wait a later. You know, hand grenade. Oh, somebody accidentally shot the Louis. It happened. So, yes, sending ROTC bozos over there, really, they got it. Anyway, so we're there. Then they send us back. They send us back to the company area, and we get back. And all I want to do is go to sleep. My goal is I'm not going to eat. It's supper time. I'm not going to eat. I'm going to just get into bunk and pass out because I can't stay awake. And then they tell us we're all going to be punished. The entire company will be punished because somebody had fraternized with an officer. What happened was you're not supposed to do that. The guy was being friendly with an officer. Oh, you're enlisted. You're not allowed to do that. You know, we had enlisted lifers with us, and they were all hot about that. So the punishment was running around the quarter-mile track with an M14 rifle held out in front of you. The M14 rifle is a pretty heavy rifle. And so holding it out in front of you, your muscles in your shoulders start to give out pretty fast. And so we run around, and then they said, people aren't holding their rifles enough. Basically, we ran about a mile that way, and people are falling apart, and some people are just falling down, and some people just drop their rifles, and oh, that's a big thing. And so basically after a mile, the whole company is in bad shape, and I'm cheating. I'm like putting my fingers in the webbing of the rifle and the sling and holding on to it and going on. And, you know, I'm cheating, but they didn't catch me because other people are even doing worse. I'm staggering. And so we get through all this stuff. And we get back at last. They put us in formation. I stand there, and you're standing at attention. And you have the rifle by your side. And I feel myself sinking. I can't keep my eyes open. I feel I can't really, it's not falling asleep, it's passing out. I can feel myself, my hand is sliding down the rifle. I'm getting lower. I'm collapsing. That's what happens, I collapse. And so a fat lifer sergeant, one of the people who had us running around, comes over, says, get up, you know, this kind of crap. Starts kicking me in the ribs. People are saying, you shouldn't kick him like that in the ribs. All right, well, ambulance is called. I go to the hospital. There, they insist, this is an Army thing. They insist I'm faking it. And so, first they take blood to look for drugs. Maybe I'm loaded. I wasn't. And there's more mistreatment. They say, oh, guys, you know, faking it. Get up, you know. And moving, shaking me like crazy, putting smelling salts under my nose. That didn't work. So then they broke the smelling salts and shoved them up my nose. Now I've got ammonia in my nasal passages, and they put their hand over my mouth so that I have to breathe it in. Oh, boy, I got scars from that. I probably still have scars in the nasal area from that. They did three spinal taps within mere minutes of each other. Now, one spinal tap is bad. They did three of them, and it was in short order. And also, they burned my hand on a radiator because they said, you know, this will do it. And so they took my hand, they put it on the radiator, the back of the hand, not the front, and, you know, where it would be, oh, you know, he might get out of the army that way. Burn the back of your hand, nobody cares. So they put my hand in the radiator and said, that'll get him up. Well, it cooked part of my hand. And finally, somebody said, why don't we take his temperature? So they took my temperature and they said, uh-oh. And they said, this is real because you can't fake a temperature. And they rapidly started saying, wow, this is a problem. The spinal taps were because they were saying, this is a spinal meningitis case. And they took the spinal taps and that wasn't it. And so they took them some more. And eventually they're just getting blood in the spinal tap because, you know, they're puncturing. So they stopped that. And after a while, no one under the rank of major worked on me because it was a mutiny. People were scared because they were doing tests now. Now they're serious. They know this is real. And it ain't spinal meningitis. What is this? 3 weeks ago, I'm this healthy kid. A day or so ago, I was this healthy kid in the army. Now I'm dying with this gigantic fever. Fever gets up to 105.8. At 106, your brain goes and, you know, that's it. And so they're scared. And so only medical doctors are there. No orderlies, no nobody, no enlisted people, no nurse people. Just these majors and above saying, what the hell is this? I remember at one point there was the cooling down procedure to try and get the fever down, and they put me on a stainless steel table with a drain in it, and they took towels and they dipped them in alcohol that was in ice. They put ice and alcohol in a vat of it, I guess. They had some kind of a big container of alcohol. And this cools down the towels very much, but it won't burn your skin off, which, you know, just putting ice on you would. So they do, and they're wrapping me in this, and I'm completely stripped naked. And they have also taken all of my clothing and everything I came in with, and they have burned it because they're so frightened. And so basically they do this, and they do what they can. They keep taking vital signs, and then they give up. They sign my death certificate. I found this out later. And so then they bring me into, you know, they don't have the proper facilities for anything. So they bring me into this tiny room in this ward, and they're going to do the autopsy because I'm dead. And they're frightened. What the hell is this? They can close this room off so whatever it is doesn't get out. One doctor is there to do the autopsy. The other doctor is there because he's just been appointed to be in charge of tracheotomies. He's never done one before. Remember, this is the army. And so he's going to be his first one. He can do it on me because it doesn't count. And he has the wrong blade, the wrong type of scalpel for it. So he goes in and he cuts. And there's a memory buffer. Before you're conscious, you got a little something going on. And there were exclamations. Because a corpse doesn't bleed the way a living body does. The blood behaves differently. And I was alive. What happened was this. My lungs were shot. And there was hardly anything, any activity from my heart. Well, there was no activity they could detect from my heart. I don't believe I was dead. I think it was just the army medical stuff from 1968 couldn't detect that I was alive. You couldn't hear the heart. I'm sure it was doing a little something. The lungs were really shot. And what happened was the heart was strong. My lungs were big from the running. I finally won my race. So there's Life Day. Well, that's been it for Back of the Book for this week. We'll be back next week. Coming up next is
Arts Express with Prairie Miller.
And it's going to get cold again. We had some warm weather. It's cold again, but at least the days are getting longer and the sun is setting close to 5:30. So enjoy what sunlight you can get. Stay warm. And above all, remember what that glad the death certificate wasn't right Dormouse said.
Massive and expensive equipment marks the professional radio station. But in the amateur field, radio parts often include pieces of assorted junk, ingeniously assembled by operators, and lots of strange radio parts, such as whiskey glasses mounted on a cake tin. Ma's funnel actually becomes a loudspeaker, and her sieve, part of a microphone. Winding a coil becomes comparatively simple when using the family egg beater. All amateurs are heroes of the air at heart and dream of a chance to serve humanity whenever a calamity occurs. And speaking of calamities, well...
Hey there, all our beloved radio listeners. Yes, we're in a bit of a calamity right now with an urgent need here at WBAI to pay our radio tower back rent or cease to broadcast. And here at this radio station, we'd like to continue to serve humanity, but without having to resort to those egg beaters and cake tins in an emergency. So please donate whatever you can by calling in to 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or visiting the Donate to Our Tower Fund at the top of the BAI website page. And Arts Express thanks you.
Hello, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, host of Exploration, which reports on the impact of science on society, which is usually heard every Wednesday evening. First of all, Exploration is moving. That's right. From now on, it'll be broadcast on Saturdays at noon. So write that down. Mark that down on your calendar. Our time slot has been moved to Saturdays at noontime. Second, let me emphasize the importance of supporting WBAI with whatever you can afford. One way is to become a WBAI buddy, a sustaining member in the name of Exploration for $10, $15 or more a month by calling 212-209-2950. Now, write that number down. It's 212-209-2950. Now, another way is to go to our website, wbai.org. Click on to the WBAI button on the upper right-hand corner of the website. So please now, call 212-209-2950. Or go to WBAI.org and make that pledge for social change.
Hey, I can't find that on the radio.
Well, tune in to WBAI and you certainly will get an earful.
You'll turn to that station. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
And you can ensure that WBAI is here for you now and in the future through WBAI's Tower Fund. Go to towerfund.wbai.org and contribute what you can to ensure that the room which houses WBAI's transmitter at 4 Times Square, which costs $17,000 a month, is paid through the coming year. Please go to towerfund@wbai.org or phone 212-209-2950.